Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Lindsey Graham is laying out the timetable for confirming President Trump's nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, federal judge Amy Coney Barrett. Graham told Fox News that confirmation hearings will begin on October 12th and that his panel will approve her by October 22nd. That would potentially set her up for a full Senate vote by the end of the month and before Election Day. Graham's comments came after Coney Barrett accepted Trump's nomination at the White House on Saturday.
I fully understand that this is a momentous decision for a president. And if the Senate does me the honor of confirming me, I pledge to discharge the responsibilities of this job to the very best of my ability. I love the United States, and I love the United States Constitution.
Coney Barrett would succeed Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who passed away about a week and a half ago. Maurice Shepard is a political science instructor at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob.
Well, what's your general reaction, first of all, to the nomination, I think mostly expected, at least coming into the weekend, of Judge Amy Coney Barrett?
Again, it's unfortunate that it had to happen because of a death with Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing. But it occurred. And I think in terms of the Republican Senate, again, nothing new here, but in 2016, they made a principal argument making the point that nominating someone and confirming someone for the Supreme Court within a year of a presidential election went against tradition. In 2020, I think the principal aspect of that is gone, and this appears to be politics. But at the same time, there is nothing unconstitutional about it. It just goes against a long tradition in terms of American politics regarding the nomination and confirmation of a Supreme Court justice when we're within a year of a presidential election.
Can you talk about some of the issues you see most at stake that court rulings could most likely be changed on with her confirmation?
Sure. There are a few that just stand right out. One would be, first and foremost, could be if she's, again, confirmed, she's successful and is placed on the bench. There may be, once again, election questions that come up during the 2020 election cycle, election season. There are also the two big ones that stand out. One is in terms of reproductive rights, Roe v. Wade, that is being challenged again in the courts. She may weigh in on that. And also what's called Obamacare. There's a question in terms of, again, the constitutionality of that legislation. She has been critical of Chief Justice Roberts in terms of what she has characterized as his support of the Affordable Care Act. And she, based on some of her past statements and some of her research writings, doesn't necessarily seem to be a strong supporter of it.
Let's take each of those in turn. I want to give a listen to Democratic Senator Cory Booker, one of the Democrats, saying that Judge Barrett should commit to recuse herself from any election-related cases that could wind up before the Supreme Court if she's confirmed in time. Here's Senator Booker on NBC yesterday.
I'm going to make it very clear. One of the things I want to ask her is, will she recuse herself? Because if she does not, in terms of any election issues that come before us, because if she does not recuse herself, I fear that the court will be further delegitimized. In other words, President Trump has said, I will not accept the result of the election unless I win. I'm going to push it to the Supreme Court. And oh, by the way, during the election, I'm going to put somebody on the court as well.
Do you think this will be a big topic of conversation, in the confirmation hearings?
Yes, it will be. And it depends in terms of the Supreme Court justices sort of recusing themselves. Justice Kagan, for example, she recuses herself when cases come before the court regarding the Affordable Care Act, because she was actually in the Obama administration when that was sort of working its way through. So there will be a discussion on that. The record on this, though, quite honestly, is that for most U.S. Supreme Court justices, recusing themselves, it's rare. It doesn't happen an awful lot, even if there is almost a blatant appearance of a conflict.
We're talking to Maurice Shepard, political science instructor at Madison College, looking at President Trump's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. You also mentioned the Affordable Care Act. There's a case coming up. It was scheduled for right after the election in mid-November. Oral arguments scheduled to begin in this legal challenge to Obamacare. Came from states. It's being backed by the Trump administration. It would effectively overturn the Affordable Care Act, all the bits of it, as I understand it. So this Supreme Court seat could be a big deal in that decision, Maurice.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is, again, there may be constitutional legal arguments against it, but there's also sort of a Democratic argument that can be made for the Affordable Care Act, that there was a candidate who ran for the presidency and won the presidency and put in place, put forward legislation. It's now the law. And it still remains the law, and that voters have had a number of opportunities, again, to voice their opinion on this, and the Affordable Care Act sort of remains. There's a question in terms of, for the court in the, is it in the business of making policy or interpreting? One of the interesting things here regarding Justice Barrett is, if she is, once again, successfully placed on the court, is Justice Antonin Scalia, that she clerked for about 1 year, I think it was between 1998 and 1999, he would regularly make the argument that the court is not here to make legislation, that is up to, again, sort of elected officials and Congress and that sort. So this will become interesting. Does she side with the court actually making policy? In some cases, some would argue negating the democratic will of the people.
Now, the Biden campaign has already talked about this part of the story with the Supreme Court, emphasizing the impact this could have on health care. We saw Democrats run pretty well on health care in 2018 in congressional elections. Do you think that this is going to be a main point that the Biden campaign and Democrats around the country are hitting over the next, 5 weeks or so?
Yes, because going back, the idea in terms of, once again, the federal court system and the courts would be, in terms of the American tradition and the American founders, that the court would be outside of politics. And that's the reason, again, that they receive a lifetime appointment to the position, the U.S. Supreme Court. In this case, again, it could be the court, again, tipping its toe, just as some would argue with Bush v. Gore, putting its toe into the area of politics and policy, in which case there may be an uproar, again, for the court stepping in and trying to legislate to the American people. Again, going back to Bush v. Gore, that challenged the idea that the court was outside of politics. When the Bush v. Gore decision was made, the U.S. Supreme Court was under tremendous pressure, and it actually reinvented itself to become much more transparent because public opinion was greatly against them in terms of, as some had perceived it, that the court selected a president and it wasn't the people actually selecting the new president.
And you mentioned also Roe versus Wade and abortion access in the United States as being another potentially pivotal issue here. Do we know much about this nominee when it comes to abortion rights and willingness to turn around past Supreme Court rulings on it?
Well, in terms of Judge Barrett, her judicial philosophy is as a originalist. And it's similar to Justice Neil Gorsuch. And the idea is that you look at the Constitution in terms of what it actually says, but also with an eye toward what would a reasonable person at the time of the writing of the Constitution, how did they view particular issues? If Judge Barrett follows along the same lines as Antonin Scalia, and Scalia made this point on a number of cases, he believed that it wasn't up to the court to overturn Roe v. Wade, that if the elected officials really wanted that to go away, they could write legislation again to their liking. There have been, in some of her writings and some comments, she seems to have made, again, this is just based on sort of limited writings and comments, that the issue of a woman's right to her body, to make her own decisions, that part may be settled. But what may not be settled is public funding for reproductive rights. So just based on, again, some of her statements and maybe parts of writings and research that she has completed, it's not a done deal in terms of if she is the successful nominee, what her position may be on Roe v. Wade.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Maurice, some Democrats are saying, hey, if Biden wins the presidency and Democrats win the Senate, they should expand the Supreme Court to retake the majority or balance out the court. The number 9, I guess, isn't in the Constitution when it comes to the Supreme Court. Biden, though, has opposed doing that, at least in the past. Do you think this is going to be, again, in that hypothetical scenario of Democratic wins, is this going to be a big debate?
I think it will be. There will be a continued debate. There's an ongoing debate with the Supreme Court in general. There are some that argue, again, that maybe 9 justices, given the caseload that they have, the caseload increases and also the caseload becomes much more complex. So there is an argument, even outside of, once again, current events, to somehow look at reforming the Supreme Court, maybe, again, adding more justices to handle the increased caseload. Also, maybe term limits, that you don't have a situation where you have individuals who are living their life's dream, but, you know, it may be, again, having term limits may be better for the court in terms of having turnover, getting new judges, justices on the court, new ideas, a fresh perspective.
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob.
Maurice Shepard is a political science instructor at Madison College. We talked to him about the nomination of Judge Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court and the upcoming confirmation battle. Tyco Fire Products in Marinette County is continuing to test wells in northeastern Wisconsin for PFAS chemicals that may be linked to firefighting foam tested at the company's property. The testing comes as the state works to create a standard for how much PFAS in groundwater will be considered too much. Danielle Kading is following the story, WPR News reporter based in Superior. Danny, welcome back.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. Give us a quick reminder, Danny. Why do we worry about PFAS chemicals?
Yeah, these are chemicals of concern because they don't break down easily in the environment, and they've been linked to harmful health issues, including thyroid disease, some reproductive issues, and also cancer.
Now, in this new round of testing, in this kind of long-running story, Tyco's looking here at wells in farm fields near Marinette and Peshtigo. What are they looking for? What did they find?
So they have been doing the sampling, as you said, on these farm fields where there are wells that may be contaminated from PFAS that has seeped in through those fields through biosolids or treated sewage sludge that has been spread on top of them. And that sewage sludge came from the Marinette wastewater treatment plant, and Tyco was discharging their wastewater from their fire training facility to the wastewater treatment plant. So basically the concern there is that PFAS is building up in this sewage sludge, and then when it's been spread on these fields, then that might be causing contamination in some of these wells.
And according to Tyco's testing in these fields, was this a problem?
Well, Tyco is saying that it's a very isolated problem, if at all. Basically, their sampling found that 94% of 183 wells sampled, so the vast majority on these fields, had very low levels of PFAS. Those were levels that are below the federal health advisory level of 70 parts per trillion, which, to try and explain that and put that into perspective, it's basically like less than one drop of water in 20 Olympic-sized swimming pools. So basically, most of these wells, they're saying, had very little contamination, and the majority that were tested, 77%, had no trace of PFAS whatsoever.
Now, the company is testing this. Does the DNR have to accept their testing?
No, they do not. The DNR has received the results of the company sampling, and they're going to be reviewing that and going through it with their hydrogeologist and other staff to kind of assess whether or not they agree with those findings, or if they've come to different conclusions and feel that maybe more sampling or testing is necessary.
So we'll watch for that. And this all comes, Danny, you write, as the state is working on setting a standard for what level of PFAS in groundwater is okay. Where does that stand?
Right. Yeah. So the state is currently in the middle of a lengthy process to develop standards to regulate PFAS in groundwater and surface water and drinking water. They kind of kicked that off, or the Natural Resources Board, I believe, approved that earlier this year. And that could take up to 30 months from the time that they approved that. And then, of course, we are in the middle of this pandemic. So it's unknown whether that might also have, you know, play a role in when those standards would be developed. But, you know, part of the reason that that's happening is because there are currently no federal standards for PFAS. They have the federal health advisory level, but the Environmental Protection Agency has yet to issue any kind of enforcement standard for those chemicals. And it could be years before a threshold or a level, a limit for safe drinking water is in place.
In our last half minute or so, Danny, is this stuff being used less these days with all this concern about it?
Yes, definitely. I believe, you know, back in the early 2000s, you know, the manufacturer of PFAS was banned by big companies and stopped using it. And it's no longer being used in the firefighting foam that was used by Tyco Fire Products, you know, and the state recently also just implemented a law was enacted this year, which bans its use other in emergency situations, that being the firefighting foam containing PFAS.
Danny, thanks as always for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Rob.
Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. She talked with us about the latest testing results for PFAS chemicals in wells in the Marinette area. Now, the pandemic has changed the kinds of questions and greetings we ask people, whether we're talking to them for the first time in a while or maybe the first time ever. Instead of just the usual, how are yous or how's your summer, we might ask, how have you been coping, or what hobby have you gotten into? Our next guest is a local author we haven't talked with in a while. We're going to catch up pandemic style. Nicholas Butler is the author of books including Shotgun Love Songs and his latest Little Faith. He lives near Eau Claire and writes a column for the Leader Telegram called Sawdust Stories. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I hear a lot of people talking about a changed pace of life and thinking maybe they want to keep some of that changed pace, maybe a slower pace, even when things go back to normal. Have you seen that in the people you know or even in your own life?
Well, I tell you, I mean, we sort of live out in the country. So when the pandemic, the stay-at-home measures first started, I felt like we were kind of perfectly situated and that our pace of life was going to not really change a whole lot. And then I have to say, like, I've missed the speed of how things were beforehand. You know, I think 2 weeks before things really went bad, I was in northern Italy and kind of traveling around Europe to promote some books. And I realized after the pandemic really went into kind of full swing, how much I missed traveling. That it was not something that I ever envisioned for my life, but it's one of the truly like sweet things that I'm really grateful for. And I just missed the freedom of being able to move, you know?
That's interesting. We talked to travel writer Rick Steve a while back, and he talked about, he loves to travel, he lives to do it. And he talked about trying to explore his own neighborhood with a traveler's mindset. Have you managed to do that at all? Look at now that you're stuck in your local surroundings, looking at them in a different way?
Yeah, my one thing that was great was that because the stay-at-home measure sort of took place as winter was, you know, fading, my wife and I would get out, and we have about an 8-mile loop that we like to walk south of Eau Claire, south of where we live. And so that was great. I mean, we had more time as a couple to exercise together and talk and kind of decompress. And that I liked very much. And I wish that was something that we continued. We did get to go out to some state parks and, you know, when everyone was just totally stir crazy in the house, and we have two kids. And so So that felt good to go up to Copper Falls State Park one day or, yeah, just exploring, you know, I mean, we're so lucky in Wisconsin to have so many great parks, and it felt good to get out and do that.
I was curious to ask you what you've been reading. That's part of what we wanted to invite you to do.
Yeah.
Check out your pandemic reading list.
Yeah.
Anything strike you or new or fun or different?
Oh, Rob, I have to tell you. So one thing that was really sort of fortuitous about the whole thing is that I guess my mom has always kept like a reading journal where she's a voracious reader, reads more than I do, faster than I do. And so she keeps like a journal where she marks down everything she's read and just some brief impressions on what she read. And I started that January 1st, 2020. And
nice.
So it has allowed me to track what I read and remember, because I don't have a great memory. And I mean, first great book of the year that I read, it's not a new book, it's something I suppose many of your listeners have read, but A Gentleman in Moscow. People had been urging me for years to read this book, and I think because I'm a little bit of a contrarian and also myself an author, I kind of, when too many people tell me a book is amazing, I start to either feel jealous or disbelieving of that. And I mean, I wish A Gentleman in Moscow was 2,000 pages long.
Wow.
Did you read that one?
I have not read that one. So I feel more a sense of a guilt when I hear things that I should have read but haven't, Nick. I mean, because it's a long list.
Yeah.
But
no,
that
I'm
sounds
sure.
like a good one. What's it about?
It's basically about this Russian aristocrat who gets placed under house arrest in a Moscow hotel. And so much time passes over the course of the book that you see him from the, I guess he's in his late 30s, early 40s as this aristocrat who's used to a certain life, and then that falls apart. But you also understand that he's an incredibly intelligent, sensitive man, and you see the ways in which he bonds with other members of the hotel staff. And, you know, I mean, it's such a – I feel like it's been just – you hear people talk about like, oh, this, I wish this year would be done. I hated this year. This was a great, I've never put a whole lot of stock into that, but I truly feel like 2020 was a miserable year. And it's the kind of book that actually brings you out of that and makes the world look brighter.
Talking to author Nicholas Butler. He lives near Eau Claire. His books include Shotgun Love Songs. Talking about life and reading during the pandemic, you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you want to share a book recommendation or tell us how your reading habits have changed, if at all, over the last 6 months or so. And do you do this reading journaling thing? Love to hear about that. 800-642-1234. Now, Nick, I got to say, this reading journal idea, I have a thing where I think about having a reading journal for literally for years, and I've never done it. Does it? I don't know. How does that change the way you read, or does it change the way you read? It sounds like a great idea.
I'm sure you read. I'm sure you sort of have to. Read a lot for your work, but you also just enjoy reading flat out.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's work reading, and then there's Rob reading. That's
yeah,
for sure.
I mean, my memory is not good. So I've just found it so handy, like when people are saying to me, well, what have you read recently? And normally I would answer that with like a pregnant pause and really have to scratch my head and think about what I'd read. And now I can kind of look back over the year and survey what I've read and what's really stuck out to me as both good and bad. And because I mostly read in bed before I fall asleep, it's also become sort of this ad hoc dream journal. It's just kind of gotten me back into the, you know, scribbling down a few lines every now and again. So when my mom told me that she'd done it, it was like one of those things that your parents do that they don't necessarily advertise, and you think, well, that's a darn good idea. And it's been fun.
So you're sticking with that?
I hope so. I don't know. We'll see. So far, so good.
Well, we asked our listeners on Facebook to share their reading thoughts. Margaret says she had always been an avid reader, but once we went into lockdown, Margaret says she couldn't focus on a book. Finally, late spring, she eased back in, rereading a couple of old favorites before cracking open and very slowly savoring the final book of Hilary Mantel's Cromwell trilogy, The Mirror and the Light. I read the first one of that That one, that's one I should pick up. But rereading, I love. I've done a little bit of this myself, Nick. Are you a rereader ever?
Not a whole lot. Part of that is because there's just like a professional responsibility to be reading other people's work, you know, and books that haven't come out yet. So, you know, there are books that I have revisited over my life, and I wish I could go back and read East of Eden, for example, right now. That'd be fun. But it just feels like there's this never-ending supply of advanced reader's copies that I got to plow through. And I'm happy to plow through, too. So
let's bring out a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bill joins us in Hale's Corners. Bill, hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. What a great show. I just turned it on, and really exciting to hear the author speaking. And I set myself a goal this year. I hadn't been reading as much as I had wanted to, and back in January, I set a goal of reading 20 books this year. And since the pandemic has hit, I just hit book number 30.
Nice.
So it's been a great reading year. And I just wanted to echo your guest sentiment. Gentleman in Moscow is one of the finest books I've read in many a year. It was just a great read, and I was so sorry that when it was done.
Wow.
And another great book I'd like to recommend, if you haven't talked about it already, is The Dutch House. I believe Patchett, perhaps, is the name of the author, but another one of my favorite books that I've read in the last 7 months.
Awesome. Thanks for those recommendations. We talked to Ann Patchett a few months back, actually. So, Nick, great ideas. Another second on this gentleman from Moscow. All right, guys, I'll check it out. We've only gotten one recommendation from you so far. Nick, hit us with another one.
Yeah. I'm a big baseball fan, and the baseball season didn't start on time. And to me, that's like as important as the, you know, the birds migrating north or something like that. It's just a change in season. So I was looking for baseball related books, and I found two great ones. One is called The Cactus League by Emily Niemans, which is a novel sort of told through a collection of short stories. And it's basically about spring training down in Arizona and the different characters that are sort of involved in this fictitious team spring training. And there's a star baseball player, there's groupies, there's coaches that have never quite risen all the way to the top. Really enjoyed that one. I also read a surprising book called The Wax Pack. I don't know if I'm going to pronounce the author's last name right, but I think it's Brad Balukjian. It's the University of Nebraska Press. And what the guy did is he got a pack of 1985 Topps baseball cards. I also happen to be a kind of closet baseball card collector. And he opened the pack, and then he went and found all 12 of the players in their retirement and just had like a cup of coffee with them and kind of checked in on where their life is now and what they recalled about being professional players. And what came out of that book for me was this notion that, what does success mean? You know, these athletes were at the pinnacle of professional sports, but now 20 years later, what does that mean? Does anyone recognize them anymore? And have their marriages fallen apart because they were on the road all the time as athletes? And I really, really like the book. It started off on kind of a, you know, I think it's fair to say like a little bit of a juvenile tone, and you're not sure if you really like the author. And then as the book progresses, you both become more attached to the author and more attached to these mostly forgotten baseball players. Really like that book a lot, too.
We're talking to Wisconsin author Nicholas Butler. His books include Little Faith and Shotgun Love Songs. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Interested in hearing about what you have read lately, and if the way you read, how much you read has changed during the pandemic, and do you keep a journal of your reading? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. The Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Nicholas Butler, Wisconsin author based in the Eau Claire area. You may know some of his books, Shotgun Love Songs, The Hearts of Men, his latest, Little Faith. He writes a column called Sawdust Stories for the Leader Telegram. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're wondering if you have a great read recommendation for us. And have you changed the way you read, how much you read, the kind of stuff you read during the pandemic? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We heard from Jocelyn on Facebook. She says she discovered the late, great mystery writer Mary Roberts Rinehart, supposedly America's Agatha Christie. Jocelyn says her books are quite the gold mine, but for some reason not widely carried by public libraries. She found some to download for free from the Gutenberg Project. Interesting. That's kind of cool, Nick, when you discover a new author that you love and find out they've written a lot of stuff. Have you ever had that, or have you had that lately?
Yeah, it's. I'm glad you asked, actually. Yeah, there's a mystery writer by the name of Tom Bowman, B-O-U-M-A-N, and I think he's based in New York State, kind of near the Pennsylvania border, and he writes these mystery. I think he's written three mysteries, reoccurring character, and they're set in kind of a Hard Knocks rural area of that part of the country, and I just can't quite put my finger on what it is about his writing, the rhythm of his writing, that just really grabs me. And when I discovered him, I ran through all three of those books, and I wish he had written. I wish he'd write faster, frankly. but I feel the same way about like William Kent Kruger's Cork O'Connor series, and I find that, you know, I think Ann Patchett mentioned this when she was on the show, but when I'm really struggling with my attention span, which can, I think, sort of happen when, you know, the news cycle is so heavy and there's so much at stake and you want to pay attention, but then you sort of get trapped in a negative feedback cycle where you're always looking at your phone. And I find that reading something a little lighter, like a mystery, can help me refocus, not just in my reading habits, but also in my writing habits, too. I can just kind of figure out what that speed is and find that attention span again. So
let's bring on another caller now. Brian is with us in Fort Atkinson. Brian, hi.
Hi. Yeah, this is Brian. I'm a totally blind person. And so, but I've read about 19 books now since the COVID-19 thing started. And
cool.
They're all in Braille.
You do Braille, or I know there's the Bard system of audiobooks, a lot of different ways. What have been some of your favorite reads so far this year, Brian?
So far it's been, I've read a Braille book by, it's Michael Conley, and his book about the witness.
Gotcha. So Brian Conley, thanks so much for sharing that, Brian, reading that in Braille. And I'll point out to people, anybody with a visual impairment, the Bard system is an excellent audiobook system. You get a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily commercially available if you have a visual impairment. That reminds me, Nick, of a long time ago, I had a buddy who was blind. And I was kind of his volunteer reader for a while for grad school. And it made me realize some books are really meant to be read out loud. Do you ever get to do that much, like out loud reading, either reading it to someone or someone reading to you?
You know, I've since the pandemic started, I've missed that. You know, when you start off as a writer, you don't necessarily, well, and you know, I'm fortunate too. I mean, I have several books out and traveling to promote those books is sort of part of my job. And I realized that, you know, when everything was normal, I sort of looked at the travel and the time spent in hotels and eating fast food. And it's easy to sort of not see the magic in what you're doing. But then after I couldn't do it, after I looked at my calendar and realized that months and months of events were canceled, and I literally, you know, went to an office supply store and bought 3 bottles of Whiteout and just, you know, tragically canceled all these things I was sort of looking forward to, I realized I love reading out loud. And I love trying to find out, like, what I've done right in my own writing and what I've done wrong. And the only way that you can find some of those molecular mistakes is when you're reading out loud. Now that I'm not going anywhere, there's plenty of reading out loud that's happening in the house, but it tends to be a second grader reading me her stories and asking about vocab words. So it's different.
That's fun too.
That is fun. Yeah.
Brian, thanks for calling. We'll go to Polly in Wauwatosa now. Polly, hi.
Yeah, I tried not to call because who likes repetition, but I couldn't keep my fingers off the dial to give another shout out for a gentleman from Moscow. It's probably, I consider
all
it.
All right, people.
Like the To Kill a Mockingbird, this is the book of our time.
Wow.
Exquisitely written. You wish there were 19 more volumes and you could follow that man into eternity.
Wow. Okay. All right, Nick. I think I'm convinced I got to read this thing, huh?
Yeah. See, these are the kind of endorsements that really bother another writer. Even as much as I like it, it's like, boy, anybody want to call up and say something nice about Shotgun Love Songs or anything now?
Thank you so much for calling in. Yet another recommendation for that. Well, I wanted to ask, Nick, I imagine this has got to be a different world for writers. And I don't know exactly how, and I assume it's different from writer to writer, obviously. How about you?
Well, I think the thing that I think of immediately is that I sincerely feel I feel bad for writers that have books coming out during this. Because a huge component of making sure that your book gets discovered by readers is being out there on the road and going to independent bookstores and making sure the staff connects with you as the writer and is, you know, hand selling your book to readers and going to public libraries. And during this time, you just can't do that. And the news cycle is so topsy turvy as well that, you know, I mean, if you were counting on a 3-minute interview being on public radio on a Saturday and then global politics just changes abruptly, you'll lose that and you lose those readers. So I feel bad for those writers that are trying to promote a book right now. Normally I feel like I'm very disciplined and, you know, I'm proud of the fact that I can publish a book every 2.5 years, but I will tell you honestly that I have not been super productive this calendar year, and it's just been, I think, that kind of simmering uncertainty it doesn't help me artistically, you know, and I felt guilty about that for a little while, and now I just feel like, okay, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to operate under these circumstances, and I don't think I have to feel bad about it or anything, but it's just so strange.
Very fair. In our last minute or so, Nick, do you find comfort in reading in this time?
For sure. I mean, I find comfort in beauty, and books have always been one of the aspects of beauty in my life, and escapism, and it's a way for me to decompress at the end of the day, and I don't... You know, honestly, it might sound dramatic, but I don't know where I would be in my life without books in the best of times. But I feel so fortunate to live in a house that's full of books that I'll never be able to, you know, have the time to finish all these books. And, it's definitely helped me in this time.
Nick, thanks so much for joining us again today.
Yeah, thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Nicholas Butler is the author of novels, including his latest, Little Faith. He writes a column in the Leader Telegram called Sawdust Stories. He's a Wisconsin author. He lives near Eau Claire.